You're listening to PX Pulse, a regular podcast bringing you fresh voices on critical issues facing HIV prevention research today. There were several cross-cutting issues grabbing headlines at AIDS 2018 in Amsterdam this past July. Primary prevention was one of them, right at the top of the agenda. That's how to keep people who are negative from acquiring HIV. The global report card from UNAIDS says the world is not on track to hit vital prevention targets for ending the epidemic. Ambassador Deborah Birx of the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief is here to talk about this. Ambassador Birx, let's talk about the effort to bring down the incidence of HIV. There were two major studies that reported data on this in Amsterdam. A trial in Botswana called BCPP found a reduction in new cases by offering testing and treatment. Another trial in Uganda and Kenya called SEARCH had more complicated results. The intervention did not do better than the control arm, but both brought down incidence. Still, notwithstanding results like this, UNAIDS says these gains are simply not enough if we're going to end the epidemic. And neither of these trials included all proven prevention options, voluntary medical male circumcision and PrEP. What do you take from these studies? How do you apply what you're learning from studies like this to what UNAIDS is calling a prevention crisis?
I think what's missing in the UNAIDS report, and it's the issue that I've always had in general when we talk about controlling this epidemic and what it should look like. So when you look globally, you're mixing and matching highly successful countries that have had, like these two countries, a 30% decline in incidence, or in like Namibia, 50% decline in incidence, or Swaziland, a 44% decline in incidence. All of these countries that are having these dramatic incidence declines, and you're grouping them in with countries who have not made as much progress and have not had the same declines. You lose the granularity, which is really your insights into what to do more of, which I think is your fundamental question. What should we be doing more of, and therefore what should we be doing less of? And I think in the countries that have been successful, they have had comprehensive programs very much driven by a coalition of the community and the government, where we're strictly there as a supporting cast. So both Kenya and Uganda have achieved about 60% to 70% voluntary medical male circumcision coverage. And that's what we're pushing for in country after country. So PEPFAR does have the largest investment in prevention of any bilateral or multilateral program because we think it is that important. And it needs to be adapted very specifically to the communities that you're serving.
How much PEPFAR money does go to primary prevention? What does it cover? And then what do you think of that number? Why is that the right number?
Well, I don't think with primary prevention we know what that right investment is. And that's what we've really been searching for. So we have nearly 25% of our resources in primary prevention, a mixture of condoms, behavioral change, voluntary medical male circumcision, PrEP, and our DREAMS program, which stands for Determined, Resilient, Empowered, AIDS-Free, and Mentored Safe Young Women. That has been remarkably successful when the countries get it right. We have some countries that showed a 50 to 60% decline in new infections in young women in just 14 months. And what did they do? Countries that did not have the same declines in incidence were offering the same services, but not in a coordinated way. So if you were a 15-year-old, you may have to go to five different sites to get the five services that you needed. The successful countries had a coordinated service coming together either in girls' clubs or in after-school activities where comprehensive services and counseling was available. And I think that's taught us a lot, and we should have known that. But sometimes you just have to see the program in action to really understand where things are going right and where we need to improve. So I think that's when I say I don't know how much money it is, because we need to now specifically cost what it costs to provide that kind of layered, comprehensive, adapted, evolving services. That's really the question for all of us. And what does that cost? Because we know it's effective when it's done right.
Okay. Noting that PEPFAR puts about 25% of its budget into primary prevention, there's a discussion about who should be paying for prevention, right? So where should the money for prevention come from?
Well, you know, this really gets back to you have to be a splitter and not a lumper. And so I think a lot of people who came out of the conference looked at the UNAIDS report and this lumping of things together and said, we're off target. This is a mess. But underneath that are countries like South Africa, that not only is investing in treatment as you defined and are 80% of the response, they launched a huge program called She Conquers, primary prevention for young women, very similar to DREAMS, building on DREAMS. We're walking side by side with them. And they understand and have invested both in treatment and prevention, and also support politically and raising awareness among leadership about the importance of circumcision. Swaziland, same thing. Large investor in treatment, but also expanding DREAMS and DREAMS-like programs to the entire country. They see the same thing in Namibia and Botswana, really them understanding the importance of prevention and treatment. And so this is not a time to be discouraged, because what you do when you say we're off track is you don't value the countries that have done an extraordinary work together to get where they are, and you miss the fact there are countries that are way behind. It is not always a resource issue. It can be a policy issue. It can be a political leadership issue. It can be, frankly, the level of stigma and discrimination at the community level that forces people into the shadows and they don't come out. So these are these kind of structural barriers, what we'd often call social determinants of health. If you just lump it all together and say we're off track, you dismiss the areas where we are on track and you don't uncover the areas where we have to do a different thing in order to be on track.
The process has begun for PEPFAR reauthorization. That's the legislative process that renews the U.S. government's commitment to PEPFAR, including, it renewing its mandate and funding and goals. How can advocates in the U.S. and around the world support this process?
I think we're in a great position to know what is needed. It's just, do we have the political will? Do we as implementers and program managers, are we going to come together in this new way with governments and communities to make this happen? Because we know what is possible.
So that's where advocates would come in.
Yes.
Botswana advocate Dorothy Okach works for one of the organizations, an NGO called Young Love, which champions strong policy and partnerships, among other things, to defeat HIV. Botswana was one of a handful of countries that UNAIDS reports is close to achieving 90-90-90, a benchmark for a strategy to stop HIV. It means 90% of the population know their HIV status, 90% of them are on treatment, and 90% of those on treatment are virally suppressed. The overall strategy to fast-track the end of the epidemic also includes several goals that focus on prevention, such as zero new infections among children and a total of 41 million men getting medically circumcised by the end of 2020. But Okach says progress on targets like these leaves a lot to be desired.
I mean, it's awesome that we've reached 90-90-90, or we are getting to reach 90-90-90. It's a really good thing. When you look at Botswana, we're one of the countries that was once leading, you know, in prevalence of HIV/AIDS. And for us to reach 90-90-90, it's a good thing. We just recently also launched this Treat All. As soon as you're tested, regardless of your CD4 count, if you're positive, you're going to go on medication, you know. And I can commend the country so much on what it's doing in the area of treatment. However, there are other things which I feel are not getting enough attention. we're all focusing on treatment now. The trend in the world now is 1990. And because the trend is on 1990, when you enter in these platforms, when you enter in the AIDS conference, you have to talk about your success of 1990 to look like you're doing something. I want to hear the stories of prevention. I want a 1990 of prevention, you know? That is what I really would want. But unfortunately, we don't have the yardstick, you know, of prevention programs. Treatment-wise, yes, we're doing awesome. We are a rich country. We can afford the treatment, you know? And because we can afford the treatment, we give it. However, even in this treatment in Botswana, unfortunately, you find that the refugee population in Botswana does not qualify to get free ARVs from the government. Basically, the ARVs are for the Botswana citizens only. Refugees, they're in our country. They live with us. You know, they may be in the refugee camp, but we enter in relationships with them. And what are you saying if me as a Botswana, I can get ARVs, but my partner who's a refugee is not going to get free ARVs? What good is that doing? You know, so there are so many human rights aspects around it. There's the programming for prevention is undermined. It's underlooked. That prevention crisis is real in Botswana.
Tell me about the gaps to prevention in Botswana. What do you see where you live and work?
This is the reality. You find that prevention programs in Botswana, unfortunately, they come as an afterthought. After we have treated people, how then can we now work on prevention? You know, it's not the main thing that goes out there. With treatment, it's easy to give statistics. You know, it's easy to say, this is the amount of people we've reached, we've put these people on treatment, so it looks like you're working, you know? But with prevention, what statistics, you know, are you going to give that's going to make them, you know? Because you can say, fine, we went to 353 schools, and, you know, we surveyed 65% of the girls, but is that telling me a story of prevention? Unfortunately, you find that a lot of CSOs in Botswana, in the world generally, they do things because it feels good. We're doing a prevention program and we've reached 500 girls. Is your program working? You don't know if your program is working.
So I understand you're calling out for metrics, for real metrics that hold people to evidence.
Let me explain it in this way. One big gap, unfortunately, is that the type of data that the donors want from CSOs is not data that actually shows the effect of the program. Donors want to know, how many people have you reached? In this district, how many people did you give the intervention to? You know, and that's what donors are going to fund. But we want them to come down to us and fund. You want to do a program? Okay, so what type of research are you going to do? Are you going to do a randomized control trial when you do this program so that after 2 years' time, when we see that it works, then we can fund you to do it for 5 years? You know, that is missing. Sometimes I feel we're not looking for programs that actually make a change, but we're looking for programs that make us look like we're doing something so we can stand on the stage and say, hey, we have done this and it's looking good. But that's not what we need.
While advocates, policymakers, funders, and implementers marshal resources and interventions into the communities hard hit by HIV, researchers continue to probe for answers about the virus and how better to stop it. AVAC's Jessica Sauls-Weedall spoke to Brad Jones of Weill Cornell Medical College. Jones says there's a lot more to learn from a part of the immune system he says is sometimes underestimated. He emphasizes that HIV research needs support and funding, and it's a gateway to progress on a host of other health issues, including cancer.
So I'm a T-cell guy. I study these killer T-cells that are kind of the foot soldiers of the immune system. Their job is to hunt around the body for cells that are infected with a virus or maybe cells that have been transformed into tumors, and then to kill those cells. And in HIV infection, these cells actually do a pretty good job. And that's often perhaps kind of a misconception. People would say that the immune response might fail in HIV, and ultimately, without treatment, that's true. But these T cell responses are probably partially responsible for why it takes years for people to progress to disease without antiretrovirals. So the immune system is doing a pretty good job. But it's not quite good enough, we know, because they can't cure infection. Even when the virus is suppressed on therapy, if you stop therapy, the virus will come back. So what my lab really wants to know is what is stopping these killer T cells from really eliminating that last bit of virus, and how, once we understand that, can we change the system through new therapies so that we can hopefully cure people? And part of the answer, and I think the conventional answer that you would hear, and it's no doubt part of the truth, is that the virus hides from the immune system and it's never seen by these T cells. But where the data are leading us recently is to thinking that this might not be the whole story. Maybe these killer T cells do see infected cells, even in people who are suppressed on therapy. But these interactions may not always lead to elimination of those target cells. So we think there might be a few dimensions of our understanding that are perhaps missing, and maybe this is why current cure therapies haven't quite had the desired effect.
I think one of the things that was really interesting for me to hear is this idea that T cells, they're actually doing a good job, up front and focusing on the immune system and this sort of natural ability to fight HIV. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how does thinking about T cells for cure relate to other parts of HIV research?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think one way to look at it is in people who aren't treated on therapy, there's a lot of viral replication happening all of the time. So new cells are always being infected. A lot of those cells are dying. When someone is treated on therapy and all of that noise is kind of quieted away, we can see these latently infected cells that we're trying to wake up and kill. And if those really are resistant to being killed in some way that we don't understand. So that's, I think, one lesson that we can learn. No doubt there are others as well. I mean, I think we need to make sure as we move forward not to think of vaccine research and cure research in silos. These two fields need to inspire each other and need to teach each other, because we need cures for infection. We want to improve the lives of people living with HIV. From a global perspective, we really need a vaccine as well.
You know, it's really interesting because at AIDS 2018, there was a lot of talk at the conference about new research. But I would say that the predominant focus, right, was on this prevention landscape, and, you know, cure and vaccines were a part of the conference, but much smaller. And I think a lot of it is because it's so much earlier in development. And what would be your argument that this is important?
We can make the pie bigger in terms of the resources that can fund these different avenues of exploration, especially if we work together to get the message out regarding how important each of these areas of inquiry are individually, but also how they can really inform each other and cross-fertilize each other, get each other past hurdles. And also inform other areas of human health. Just one example of a case where discovery in HIV, which is the role of a molecule called PD-1 in suppressing these killer T cells, has ended up cross-fertilizing the cancer field. And it actually stands for Program Death 1. So it's kind of a flag that one of these killer T cells puts up on its surface when it is exhausted, is the term that we use. It's been fighting a virus, it's been fighting a cancer for so long that it becomes less functional. And that turns out to be one of the reasons why, even though the T cell response to HIV does a pretty good job, it eventually fails. These killer T cells are literally exhausted. So that's essentially what's happening in the cancer field, is people are reinvigorating these T cells by targeting this molecule, and something that's also being explored for HIV. And that's gone on to develop life-saving therapies for cancers.
I think that piece that you're saying is so critical, the idea that basic research, you really don't know what's going to come out of it or what comes out of it, how it can be used.
So, of course, I think so. And part of the answer might be, what if everyone knew today that there would never be a cure for HIV because no one is researching it? I think that might have potentially an impact on people's you know, maybe it's something that's a source of hope and of inspiration for the field. So I think as long as we're going to the lab and having resources to push those agendas forward in a real way, we are supporting that hope and living up to that hope.
You've been listening to PX Pulse, a regular podcast bringing you fresh voices on critical issues facing HIV prevention research today.